He was too busy training the cat.
I can show you the cat, if you wish, offered Korovyov.
Nikanor Ivanovich, in turn, declined this offer. The interpreter then made him an unexpected but most intriguing proposition. In view of the fact that Mr. Volant did not wish to live in a hotel, and since he was used to having a lot of room, wouldn't it be possible for the House Committee to rent him the entire apartment, including the rooms that belonged to the deceased, for the week of Volant's performance in Moscow?
After all, it's hardly a matter of concern to him, to the deceased,
hissed Korovyov in a whisper.
You will agree, won't you, Nikanor Ivanovich, that he has no further use for this apartment?
Somewhat confused, Nikanor Ivanovich protested that foreigners were supposed to stay at the Metropole and not in private apartments.
I tell you, he's fussy as the devil, whispered Korovyov. He just doesn't want to, doesn't like hotels. I've had it up to here with these foreign visitors.
Korovyov complained confidentially, poking a finger at his veiny neck.
Believe me, they run you ragged. They come here, and they either snoop around like a son of a bitch, or they wear you out with their whims. This isn't right, that isn't right. Besides, Nikanor Ivanovich, your committee has everything to gain and nothing to lose. He doesn't begrudge any expense.
Korovyov glanced around, and then whispered in the chairman's ear,
He's a millionaire.
The interpreter's proposition made a lot of practical sense. It was a very solid proposal, but there was something decidedly unsolid about his manner of speaking, his attire, and that sickening, totally useless pince-nez. As a result, a vague sense of uneasiness troubled the chairman's soul, but he decided to accept the offer anyway. The fact of the matter was that the House Committee had incurred, alas, an enormous deficit. They had to buy heating oil for the fall, and where the money would come from was a mystery. Maybe the foreign visitors' money would get them out of the hole. Even so, the businesslike and cautious Nikanor Ivanovich said that he would first have to clear the matter with the in-tourist office.
I understand, screeched Korovyov. How could you not sort things out? It's essential. Here's the telephone, Nikanor Ivanovich. Why don't you sort them out right away? And don't be embarrassed to ask for money, he added in a whisper as he drew the chairman toward the phone in the hall. Who can you get money from, if not from him? If you could only see the villa he has in Nice next summer when you go abroad, make sure you go and have a look. You'll faint.
All the arrangements with the in-tourist office were made over the phone with a swiftness that amazed the chairman. It turned out that they already knew about Mr. Volant's plans to stay in Likhodyeyev's private apartment, and they had no objections whatsoever.
Marvelous! Cried Korovyov.
A bit dazed by his constant chatter, the chairman said that the House Committee agreed to rent apartment number 50 for a week to the artiste Volant at the rate of... Nikanor Ivanovich stammered somewhat and said,
500 rubles a day.
At this point, Korovyov really bowled the chairman over. Winking roguishly in the direction of the bedroom where the cushioned leaps of a heavy cat could be heard, he hissed,
That comes to 3,500 for the week, right?
Nikanor Ivanovich quite expected him to add, You've got quite an appetite, don't you, Nikanor Ivanovich? But again Korovyov surprised him.
You call that money? Ask for 5,000. He'll pay it.
Nikanor Ivanovich gave a confused grin and failed to notice that he was standing next to the deceased's writing desk, where Korovyov was drawing up two copies of a contract with great speed and agility. Next, he whisked them into the bedroom and returned with both copies signed in the foreigner's scrawling hand. The chairman signed the contract, too. Here, Korovyov asked for a receipt for the 5,000.
Write it out, Nikanor Ivanovich, write it out. 5,000 rubles.
And then, in a manner ill-suited to the seriousness of the occasion, he said,
Eins, zwei, drei, as he counted out five stacks of fresh banknotes for the chairman. This was done to the accompaniment of Korovyov's little jokes and quips, such as, a penny saved is a penny earned, a fool and his money are soon parted, and other things of that sort. After recounting the money, the chairman took the foreigner's passport from Korovyov in order to make out a temporary residence permit and then put it, along with the contract and the money, into his briefcase. Unable to control himself, he bashfully asked for a free pass to the show. "Why, of course," bellowed Korovyov. "How many tickets would you like, Nikanor Ivanovich? 12? 15? The dumbfounded chairman explained that he needed only two tickets for himself and his wife, Pelageya Antonovna. Korovyov grabbed a notepad and jauntily wrote out a pass for two in the front row. As the interpreter thrust the free pass at Nikanor Ivanovich with his left hand, he used his right to press a fat wad of crisp bills into the chairman's other hand. The latter took one look at them, blushed hard, and tried to push them away. "We're not supposed to," he muttered. "I won't take no for an answer," Korovyov whispered in his ear. "We're not supposed to, but foreigners are. You'll offend him, Nikanor Ivanovich, and that would be unfortunate after all the trouble you went to." "It's strictly enforced," the chairman whispered in the softest of tones and looked furtively around. "But where are the witnesses?" Korovyov whispered in his other ear. "I ask you, where are they? What's your problem?" And it was then, as the chairman insisted afterwards, that the miracle took place. The wad of bills crawled into his briefcase all on its own. Then, in a weakened and even disoriented state, the chairman found himself on the staircase. A jumble of thoughts whirled around in his head. The villa in Nice, the trained cat, the thought that there had indeed been no witnesses, and that Pelageya Antonovna would be thrilled about the free pass. They were disjointed thoughts, but pleasant on the whole. And still, the chairman felt a pinprick somewhere in the depths of his soul. A pinprick of disquietude. A thought hit him like a blow on the head right there on the staircase. How did the interpreter get into the study if there was a seal on the door? And why hadn't he, Nikanor Ivanovich, asked about that? For a while, the chairman gazed goggle-eyed at the stairs like a sheep. But then he decided to forget the whole thing and not to torture himself over something so complicated. No sooner had the chairman left the apartment than a low voice came from the bedroom. "I didn't like that, Nikanor Ivanovich. He is a skinflint and a swindler. Can't we make sure he doesn't come round here again?" "Monsieur, your wish is my command," Korovyov replied from somewhere, but in a pure and resonant voice, not a quavering one. And immediately the accursed interpreter appeared in the hall, dialed a number, and began to whine into the phone. "Hello, I consider it my duty to inform you that our House Committee chairman here at 302B Sadovaya Street, Nikanor Ivanovich Bosoy, is speculating in foreign currency. At the present moment there are $400 wrapped in newspaper in the ventilator shaft of his toilet in apartment number 35. My name is Timofey Kvastsov, and I live in apartment number 11 in the same building. But I ask that you not reveal my name. I am afraid that the aforementioned chairman will try to get even." Then he hung up. The scoundrel. What happened next in apartment number 50 is unknown. But what happened next in Nikanor Ivanovich's apartment is known. The chairman locked himself in the toilet and took out of his briefcase the packet of bills that had been forced on him by the interpreter and checked to make sure that it contained 400 rubles. He then wrapped the packet in a piece of newspaper and stuffed it into the ventilator shaft. 5 minutes later, the chairman was sitting at the table in his small dining room.
From the kitchen, his wife brought him a plate of neatly sliced herring, smothered with chopped scallions. Nikanor Ivanovich poured himself a small carafe of vodka, drank it down, poured another, drank that down, speared 3 pieces of herring on his fork, and at that moment, the doorbell rang. Pelageya Antonovna had just brought in a steaming saucepan, one glance at which was enough to guess that the pan contained, in the very thick of the piping hot borscht, the most delicious thing in the world, a marrow bone. His mouth watering, Nikanor Ivanovich began howling like a dog. "Damn you to hell, they won't even let you eat. Don't let anyone in. I'm not here, I'm not here. If it's about the apartment, tell them to stop hounding me. There'll be a meeting in a week." His wife ran into the entry hall, while Nikanor Ivanovich dipped a ladle into the fire-breathing lake and fished out the bone, which was cracked lengthwise. At that moment, 2 men walked into the dining room, accompanied by a very pale Pelageya Antonovna. One look at the men, and Nikanor Ivanovich turned pale too, and got up from the table. "Where's the toilet?" asked the first man with an air of concern. He was wearing a white Russian-style shirt. Something knocked against the dining table. It was Nikanor Ivanovich, who had dropped his spoon on the oilcloth. "Over here, here," babbled Pelageya Antonovna. And the visitors headed straight into the hall. "What's this all about?" asked Nikanor Ivanovich, trailing behind the men. "Nothing like that could be in our apartment, and can I see your ID? Excuse me." The first man handed Nikanor Ivanovich his ID, and the second one proceeded to stand up on a stool in the toilet and thrust his hand into the ventilator shaft. Nikanor Ivanovich's eyes grew dim. They removed the newspaper, but the package turned out to contain not rubles, but some unknown currency that was blue-green in color and had a picture on it of an old man. Nikanor Ivanovich saw all this in a haze, however. Spots were swimming in front of his eyes. "There are dollars in the ventilator shaft," said the first man thoughtfully. In a soft and polite voice, he asked Nikanor Ivanovich, "Does this packet belong to you?"
"No," replied Nikanor Ivanovich in a terrified voice. "My enemies planted it there."
"That does sometimes happen," agreed the first man, and added again softly, "But you'll have to hand over the rest of it, too."
"I don't have any, nothing at all. I swear to God, I've never even touched this stuff," screamed the chairman in desperation.
He rushed over to the bureau, pulled out a creaky drawer, and took out his briefcase, all the while crying out disconnected phrases.
"Here's the contract. That filthy interpreter planted it there. Korovyov, the guy with the pince-nez."
He opened the briefcase, looked inside, and thrust his hand in. His face turned blue, and he dropped the briefcase into the borscht. There was nothing in the briefcase, neither Stjopa's letter, nor the contract, nor the foreigner's passport, nor the money, nor the free pass. In short, nothing but the folding ruler.
"Comrades," shouted the chairman in a fury, "take them into custody. There are evil powers in this building."
No one knows what came over Pelageya Antonovna at that point, but she waved her arms and shouted,
"Confess, Ivanovich, you'll get off easier."
Nikanor Ivanovich's eyes became bloodshot, and he raised his fists over his wife's head, shouting hoarsely,
"Oh, you damned fool!"
Then he felt weak and sank into a chair, evidently deciding to bow to the inevitable. In the meantime, out on the landing, Timofey Kondratyevich Kvastsov was putting first his ear and then his eye to the keyhole of the chairman's apartment, dying of curiosity. 5 minutes later, the residents of the building who were in the courtyard at the time saw the chairman being led to the entrance gates by 2 men. It was reported that Nikanor Ivanovich looked terrible, tottered like a drunk as he passed by, and was mumbling something. An hour later, an unknown man appeared in apartment number 11, just as Timofey Kondratyevich was choking with glee and telling the other residents how the chairman had been carted off to jail. The stranger beckoned with his finger for Timofey Kondratyevich to come out of the kitchen and into the hall. He said something to him, and then they both vanished. Chapter 10. News from Yalta. At the same time as disaster struck Nicanor Ivanovich, not far from 302B, on that same Sadovaya Street, two men sat in the office of the financial director of the Variety Theater, Rimsky himself and Varanuha, the theater manager. Two windows of the large second-floor office looked out on Sadovaya Street, and another, behind the financial director who was sitting at his desk, looked out on the Variety's summer garden, where there were soft drink stands, a shooting gallery, and an open-air stage. Apart from the desk, the office furnishings included a bunch of old theater bills hanging on the wall, a small table with a carafe of water, four armchairs, and a dusty, time-worn scale model of some stage review set up on a stand in the corner. Well, it goes without saying that the office also contained a small fireproof safe, battered and chipped, which stood on Rimsky's left next to the desk. Rimsky, who was sitting at the desk, had been in a foul mood since morning. Varanuha, on the other hand, was very animated and somehow especially restless and energetic. For the time being, he had no outlet for his nervous energy. Varanuha had taken refuge in the financial director's office in order to escape from the free ticket hounds who poisoned his existence, especially on days when there was a change of program. And today was just such a day. As soon as the phone began to ring, Varanuha picked up the receiver and lied into it. "Who? Varanuha? He's not here. He's left the theater."
"Call Likhodyev again, please," said Rimsky in irritation.
"He's not home. I already sent Karpov over. There's no one in his apartment."
"The devil knows what's going on," hissed Rimsky, clicking his adding machine.
The door opened, and an usher came in, dragging a thick stack of additional theater bills hot off the press. Printed in large red letters on green sheets of paper was, "Today and every day at the Variety Theater, an added attraction. Professor Volant performs black magic with an exposé in full." Varanuha stepped back from the playbill, which he had draped over the scale model, admired it, and ordered the usher to paste them up everywhere. "It looks good, eye-catching," noted Varanuha as the usher was leaving.
"Well, I don't like this venture at all," grumbled Rimsky,
gazing angrily at the playbill through his horn-rimmed glasses.
"And I'm amazed they've allowed him to perform at all."
"No, Grigory Danilovich, don't say that. It was a very shrewd move. The whole point of it is the exposé."
I don't know. It has no point at all, as far as I'm concerned. And besides, Stjopa's always dreaming up things like this. If only he'd let us have a look at the magician. Have you seen him? Where the hell did they dig him up?"
It was obvious that neither Varanuha nor Rimsky had seen the magician. Yesterday, Stjopa, like a madman, to quote Rimsky, had run in to see the financial director with the draft of a contract, ordered him to draw it up and to authorize payment. And the magician had disappeared, and no one had seen him except Stjopa. Rimsky took out his watch, saw it was 2:05, and became positively enraged. This was the limit. Likhodyev had called around 11 and said that he would be there in half an hour. Not only had he not come, he had disappeared from his apartment.
"I've got work to do," snarled Rimsky, poking his finger at a pile of unsigned papers.
"Maybe he's fallen under a streetcar, like Berlioz," said Varanuha, holding the receiver to his ear and listening to the deep, prolonged, and utterly hopeless ringing.
"Wouldn't be so bad," said Rimsky through his teeth in barely audible tones.
At that very moment, a woman walked into the office, wearing a uniform jacket, a cap, a black skirt, and sneakers. She removed a small white square and a notebook from her waist pouch and asked, "Is this the Variety? Express telegram for you. Sign, please." Varanuha left a scrawl in the woman's notebook, and as soon as the door closed behind her, he opened the square. After reading the telegram, he blinked and handed it to Rimsky. The telegram read as follows. "Yalta, Moscow. Variety. Today, 11:30, Criminal Investigation Department. Appeared nightshirt, trouser-clad, brown-haired psycho, allegedly Likhodyev, Director Variety. Wire Yalta, CID, whereabouts, Director Likhodyev."
"Yeah, sure, and I'm your Aunt Mary," exclaimed Rimsky, and added, "One more surprise."
"A false Dmitri," said Varanuha, and he began speaking into the phone. "Telegraph office, charge to Variety. Take a telegram. Are you listening? Yalta Criminal Investigation Department. Director Likhodyev, Moscow. Financial Director Rimsky." Taking no heed of the communique about the Yalta impostor, Varnucha again picked up the phone to try to find out where Stjopa was, and, naturally, he could not locate him anywhere. Just as he was holding the receiver in his hand, trying to figure out where to call next, the same woman who had brought the first telegram reappeared and handed him a new envelope. Varnucha opened it in haste, read what was written, and whistled. "What now?" asked Rimsky, twitching nervously. Varnucha handed him the telegram in silence, and the financial director read the following words.
"Please believe. Transported Yalta. Volant's hypnosis. Wire CID confirmation identity. Nikodyev."
Rimsky and Varnucha, their heads touching, reread the telegram, and when they finished, they stared at each other in silence.
"Citizens," said the woman angrily, "sign for it and then you can be quiet for as long as you want. I've got telegrams to deliver."
Varnucha, still staring at the telegram, scribbled something in the notebook and the woman disappeared.
"Weren't you talking to him on the phone just after 11?
Asked the manager in complete bewilderment.
"Oddly enough, yes," cried Rimsky in piercing tones. "But whether I talked to him or not is irrelevant. He can't possibly be in Yalta now. That's absurd."
"He's drunk," said Varnucha.
"Who's drunk?" asked Rimsky,
and again they both stared at each other. That an impostor or lunatic had sent a telegram from Yalta was beyond doubt. What was odd, though, was how the Yalta jokester could have known about Volant, who had arrived in Moscow only yesterday. How could he know about the connection between Likhodeyev and Volant?
"Hypnosis," said Varnucha, repeating the word in the telegram. "How did he hear about Volant?"
He crinkled up his eyes and suddenly announced decisively,
"No, this is nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. Where the devil is this Volant staying?" asked Rimsky.
Varnucha got in touch with the in-tourist office immediately and reported, to Rimsky's complete surprise, that Volant was staying in Likhodeyev's apartment. He then dialed Likhodeyev's apartment and listened to the phone ring repeatedly and insistently. In between rings, he could hear from somewhere far away a deep, somber voice singing, "The Cliffs, My Refuge." And Varnucha decided that a voice from some radio station had somehow cut into the telephone circuit.
"There's no answer at the apartment," said Varnucha, hanging up the phone. "Perhaps I should try again."
He didn't finish his sentence. The same woman appeared in the door again, and both Rimsky and Varnucha got up to meet her, but this time it was a dark sheet of paper that she removed from her bag, rather than a small white square.
"This is beginning to get interesting," said Varnucha through his teeth, staring after the woman as she made a quick exit.
Rimsky was the first to get hold of the sheet. Against the dark background of the photographic paper, one could clearly make out black, handwritten lines. "Proof, my handwriting, my signature. Wire confirmation. Put Volant under secret surveillance. Likhodeyev." During his 20 years in the theater, Varnucha had seen a lot of things, but now he felt as if a shroud were covering his brain, and he was unable to say anything except the trite and, moreover, utterly absurd phrase, "This can't be." Rimsky, on the other hand, reacted differently. He got up, opened the door, and roared at the messenger girl sitting on the stool outside,
"Don't let anyone in unless they have mail to deliver,"
and locked the door. Then he took a pile of papers out of his desk and began a careful comparison of the bold, backward-slanting letters in the photogram and the letters in Stjopa's memoranda and in his signatures, which were embellished with a spiral flourish. Varnucha leaned over the desk and breathed hotly on Rimsky's cheek.
"It's his handwriting, all right,"
the financial director finally pronounced, and Varnucha echoed him,
"His, indeed."
When Varnucha looked into Rimsky's face, he was amazed by the change that had taken place. The already thin financial director seemed to have gotten even thinner, and to have aged, and the eyes behind his horn-rimmed glasses had lost their customary sharpness and expressed not only alarm but sorrow as well. Varnucha did everything you expect someone to do who is in a state of shock. He ran around the office and raised his arms up twice, like someone crucified, drank a whole glass of yellowish water from the carafe,
and exclaimed, "I don't understand. I don't understand. I do not understand."
Rimsky stared out the window, thinking intensely about something. The financial director was in a very difficult position. He had to devise, right on the spot, an ordinary explanation for out-of-the-ordinary happenings. The financial director narrowed his eyes and tried to imagine Stjopa, shoeless and in a nightshirt, getting on some unheard-of super-fast plane at around 11:30 in the morning, and then also at 11:30 the same Stjopa standing in his socks at the airport in Yalta. The devil knew how.
Maybe it wasn't Stjopa who called him from his apartment. No, it was Stjopa, as if he didn't know Stjopa's voice. And even if it hadn't been Stjopa on the phone that morning, it was certainly Stjopa who appeared in his office as recently as yesterday evening, bringing that foolish contract and annoying the financial director with his thoughtlessness. How could he have left town or taken a plane without telling the theater? And even if he had taken a plane last night, he couldn't have gotten there by noon today.
Or could he? How many kilometers is it to Yalta?
Asked Rimsky. Baranucha stopped his running about and shouted, I thought of that. I already thought of that. By train to Sevastopol, it's about 1,500 kilometers. And it's another 80 kilometers from there to Yalta. But by air, of course, it's less.
Yes, trains were out of the question. But what then? A fighter plane? Who would let Stjopa on a fighter plane without shoes? Why? Maybe he took off his shoes when he arrived in Yalta. Again, why? Besides, they wouldn't have let him on a fighter plane, even with shoes. And what did a fighter plane have to do with it?
Still, they had it in writing that he appeared at the Criminal Investigation Department at 11:30 in the morning. But he was talking on the phone in Moscow. Wait a minute. At that point, the face of Rimsky's watch suddenly appeared before his eyes. He remembered where the hands had been. God, it had been 11:20. So where does that leave us? If we assume that Stjopa left for the airport right after our conversation and got there in, say, 5 minutes, which, by the way, is also inconceivable, then we are left to conclude that the plane took off right on the spot and covered more than 1,000 kilometers in just 5 minutes, meaning that it traveled at more than 1,200 kilometers per hour. That's impossible. So he can't be in Yalta. What other explanation was there? Hypnosis? There was no hypnosis in the world that could propel someone more than 1,000 kilometers. So is he only imagining that he's in Yalta? He's imagining it, perhaps, and the Yalta CID is imagining it too? No. You'll have to excuse me, but things like that don't happen. But hadn't they sent a wire from there? The financial director's face looked literally horror-struck. Meanwhile, the doorknob was being pulled and twisted from the outside, and the messenger girl was heard shouting desperately, "You can't go in! I won't let you! Even if you kill me, there's a meeting!" Rimsky did his utmost to control himself, picked up the phone and said, "Connect me with Yalta. It's urgent."
"Smart!" Voronucha exclaimed to himself.
But the call to Yalta did not go through. Rimsky hung up the phone and said,
"The line's out of order. As if out of spite."
It was obvious that the faulty line had a particularly devastating effect on Rimsky and even made him reflective. After musing for a while, he again picked up the receiver with one hand and with the other began writing down what he was saying into the phone.
"Take an express telegram. Variety. Yes. Yalta. Criminal Investigation Department. Yes. Today, around 11:30, Likhodyeyev phoned me in Moscow. Stop. After that, missed work and cannot be located by phone. Stop. Handwriting confirmed. Stop. Steps taken to put said artiste under surveillance. Financial Director Rimsky."
Very smart, thought Baranucha.
But before he could think it properly, these words echoed in his head.
It's stupid. He can't be in Yalta.
Meanwhile, Rimsky did the following. He neatly folded all the telegrams that had been received, put them in a packet along with a copy of the telegram he had sent, put the packet into an envelope, sealed it, wrote something on it, and then handed it to Voronucha, saying,
"Ivan Savelyevich, take this over in person right away. Let him figure it out."
Now, that's really smart, thought Voronucha, and he stuffed the envelope into his briefcase.
Then, just in case, he dialed Stjopa's apartment again, listened, winked joyously and mysteriously, and smirked. Rimsky stretched his neck to listen. "May I speak to the artiste, Voland?" Varonucha asked sweetly.
"They're busy," a crackling voice replied. "Who may I say is calling?"
"The manager of the Variety Theatre, Varonucha."
"Ivan Savyeldovich," the receiver exclaimed joyously. "I'm terribly happy to hear your voice. How's your health?"
"Merci," the astonished Varonucha replied. "And who am I speaking to?"
"The assistant. His assistant and interpreter, Korovyov," crackled the receiver. "I'm at your service, my dear Ivan Savyeldovich. Tell me how I can be of help to you. Well?"
"Excuse me, but is Stepan Bogdanovich Lekhodyeyev not at home?"
"Alas, no, he's not," shouted the receiver. "He's gone."
"Where to?"
"He went for a drive outside of town."
"What's that, a drive? And when will he be back?"
"He said I'm just going out for some fresh air, and I'll be right back."
"I see," said Varonucha, completely at a loss. "Merci. Be so kind as to tell Monsieur Voland that he will be appearing today in the third part of the program."
"I will indeed, but of course, without fail, right away, to be sure. I'll tell him,"
tapped out the receiver abruptly. "All the best," said the astonished Varonucha.
"Please accept," said the receiver, "my best, my warmest wishes and regards. I wish you success, good luck, complete happiness, everything."
"Well, of course, it's just what I said," cried the manager excitedly. "He didn't go to any Yalta. He just went for a ride in the country."
"If that's the case," said the financial director, turning pale with rage, "words can't describe what a swine he is."
Here the manager jumped up and let out such a shout that Rimsky shuddered.
I just remembered. There's a Crimean restaurant, just opened up in Pushkino, called the Yalta. That solves everything. He must have gone there, had too much to drink, and started sending us telegrams."
"This is really too much," replied Rimsky, his cheek twitching and his eyes blazing with real fury. "Well, he'll pay a heavy price for this little jaunt."
He suddenly broke off and added hesitantly,
"But what about the criminal investigation department?"
"That's absurd. More of his little games," interjected the affable Varonucha, who then asked, "So should I take this packet over anyway?"
"Absolutely," answered Rimsky.
Again the door opened, and in walked the same woman.
"She's back," thought Rimsky with inexplicable anguish, and both of them stood up to meet her.
This time the telegram read as follows. "Thanks. Confirmation. Send me ASAP, 500 rubles, CID, flying Moscow tomorrow. Lekhodyeyev."
"He's lost his mind," said Varonucha weakly.
But Rimsky jingled his key, took some money out of the safe, counted out 500 rubles, rang for the messenger, gave him the money, and sent him off to the telegraph office.
"Good heavens, Grigory Danilovich," said Varonucha, not believing his eyes. "If you ask my opinion, you're throwing the money away."
"It'll come back," Rimsky replied softly. "And that little outing will cost him plenty."
Then he added, pointing to Varonucha's briefcase,
"Get going, Ivan Savyeldovich. Don't delay."
And Varonucha ran out of the office with the briefcase. When he went downstairs, he saw an extremely long line at the box office and learned from the cashier that she expected to be sold out within the hour because the public had come in droves after seeing the additional playbills. Varonucha told the cashier to set aside 30 of the best seats in the orchestra and loges, and then rushed out of the box office. After fighting off the obnoxious free-pass seekers, he ducked into his office to grab his cap. At that moment, the phone rang.
"Yes," shouted Varonucha.
"Ivan Savyeldovich?"
inquired the receiver in a loathsome nasal twang.
"He's not in the theater,"
Varonucha was about to shout back, but the receiver immediately cut him off.
"Don't play the fool, Ivan Savyeldovich. Just listen. Don't take those telegrams anywhere. And don't show them to anyone."
"Who is this speaking?" roared Varonucha. "Stop playing games, citizen. You'll be exposed. What's your number?"
"Varonucha," sounded the same loathsome voice. "Do you understand Russian? Do not take those telegrams anywhere."
"So you're not going to stop?" shouted the manager in a frenzy. "Well, you better watch out. You'll pay for this."
He shouted yet another threat, but then stopped, because he sensed that there was no longer anyone listening to him on the line. At this point, the office somehow suddenly began to get dark. Barnucha ran out, slammed the door behind him, and hurried out to the summer garden through the side door. The manager was agitated and full of energy. After the impudent phone call, he was convinced that a band of hooligans was playing nasty tricks, and that the tricks had something to do with Likhodyeyev's disappearance. A desire to unmask the villains overcame the manager, and, strange as it may seem, he began to experience a sense of pleasant anticipation. This happens when someone is seeking to be the center of attention, the bearer of sensational news. In the garden, the wind blew in the manager's face and got sand in his eyes, as if it were trying to bar his way or give him a warning. A window on the second floor banged so hard that the glass almost flew out. The tops of the maples and lindens rustled uneasily. It got dark and turned cooler. The manager rubbed his eyes and saw a yellow-bellied thundercloud crawling low over Moscow. A muffled growl was heard in the distance. Although Varonucha was in a hurry, an irresistible urge compelled him to run into the outside toilet for a second to check if the electrician had put netting over the light. He ran past the shooting gallery and into the thick clump of lilac bushes which sheltered the pale blue lavatory facility. The electrician turned out to have been efficient, for the lamp under the eaves of the men's room was already encased in wire mesh. But the manager was upset to see that even in the pre-storm darkness, pencil and charcoal graffiti were visible on the walls. "What is this?" began the manager, when suddenly a voice behind him purred, "Is that you, Ivan Savelyevich?" Varonucha shuddered, turned around and saw a short, fat fellow with what seemed to be a cat's face. "It is!" came Varonucha's hostile reply.
"How very, very nice," said the cat-like fat man in a squeaky voice, and then he suddenly whirled around and gave the manager such a smack on the ear that his cap flew off his head and disappeared into the toilet without a trace.
The blow flooded the whole lavatory with tremulous light for an instant, and a clap of thunder sounded overhead. Then the light flashed again, and another figure appeared before the manager. He was short and had fiery red hair, the shoulders of an athlete, a walleye, and a fang. This second fellow, apparently a lefty, landed a blow to the manager's other ear. The sky thundered again in reply, and a downpour hit the wooden roof of the lavatory.
"What are you doing? Come on,"
whispered the half-crazed manager, only then realizing that the word comrades was hardly appropriate for thugs attacking a man in a public restroom. After croaking out citizen, he realized they didn't deserve that name either, and received a third horrible blow, he didn't know who from, which made his nose bleed and spattered the fat man.
"What have you got in the briefcase, you parasite?" screamed the cat-like figure in a piercing voice. "Telegrams? Weren't you warned over the phone not to take them anywhere? I'm asking you, weren't you?"
"I was warned, spluttered the manager, gasping for breath.
"But you ran off anyway. Hand over the briefcase, scum!" shrieked the other one in the same nasal twang that had been heard over the phone, whereupon he pulled the briefcase out of Varonucha's trembling hands.
And the two of them grabbed the manager under the arms, dragged him out of the garden, and hauled him down Sadovaya Street. The thunderstorm was raging with full fury. Water groaned and droned and gushed into the sewers, bubbled and swelled in waves, lashed down from the roofs, past the drain pipes, poured through the gateways in foaming streams. Every living being had been washed away from Sadovaya Street, and there was no one to save Ivan Savelyevich. It took the thugs only a second to leap through the turbid waters in the glare of the lightning and drag the manager to number 302B. As they flew in the gateway with him, two barefoot women were huddled against the wall, clutching their shoes and stockings in their hands. The thugs then headed for entrance number 6, and Varonucha, close to madness, was hauled up to the fifth floor and tossed into the familiar semi-dark hallway of Stjopa Likhodyeyev's apartment. Here the two hoodlums vanished, and in their place appeared a girl who was stark naked. She had red hair and burning phosphorescent eyes. Realizing that this was the worst thing to have happened to him, Varonucha let out a groan and backed into the wall. But the girl walked right up to the manager and laid the palms of her hands on his shoulders.
The manager's hair stood on end because he could sense, even through the cold, soaking fabric of his peasant shirt, that those palms were colder still, cold as ice.
"Come, let me give you a kiss," said the girl tenderly, her shining eyes coming right up to his.
Varenuka lost consciousness and did not feel the kiss.
This ends Disc 4. The Master and Margarita, Disc 5.
Chapter 11. Ivan is split in two. The wood on the opposite shore of the river, which just an hour ago had been shining in the May sun, now grew blurry and dim, and then dissolved. A veil of water hung outside the window. Threads of lightning kept flashing in the sky, the heavens split open, and a fearsome, flickering light flooded the sick man's room. Ivan cried softly as he sat on his bed and looked out at the turbid, frothing, bubbling river. With every clap of thunder he let out a piteous cry and covered his face in his hands. Sheets of paper covered with Ivan's writing lay on the floor. They had been blown about by the wind, which had swept through the room before the storm began. The poet's attempts to compose a report on the terrible consultant had come to nothing. As soon as he received a pencil stub and some paper from the stout nurse, whose name was Praskovya Fyodorovna, he had rubbed his hands together in a businesslike fashion and hastily set to work at the bedside table. He had dashed off a smart beginning. "To the police. From Ivan Nikolaevich Bezdomny. Member of Masorit. Report. Yesterday evening I arrived at Patriarch's Ponds with the deceased Berlioz." And the poet immediately became confused, largely due to the word deceased. It made everything sound absurd from the start. How could he have arrived somewhere with the deceased? Dead men don't walk. They really will think I'm a madman. Such thoughts made him start revising. The second version came out as follows. With Berlioz, later deceased. That didn't satisfy the author either. He had to write a third version, and that came out even worse than the other two. With Berlioz, who fell under a streetcar. What was irksome here was the obscure composer who was Berlioz's namesake. He felt compelled to add, not the composer. Tormented by these two Berliozes, Ivan crossed everything out and decided to begin with a strong opening that would immediately get the reader's attention. He began with a description of the cat boarding the streetcar, and then went back to the episode of the severed head. The head and the consultant's prediction made him think of Pontius Pilate. And in order to make the report more convincing, he decided to include the whole story about the procurator, starting with the moment when he came out onto the colonnade of Herod's palace, dressed in a white robe with a blood-red lining. Ivan worked hard, crossing out what he had written and adding new words. He even tried to do drawings of Pontius Pilate and of the cat on its hind legs. But the drawings didn't help either, and the more the poet worked, the more confused and incomprehensible his report became. By the time an ominous storm cloud with smoking edges had appeared from the distance and enveloped the woods, and the wind had blown the papers off the table, Ivan felt drained of energy and unable to cope with the report. Making no effort at all to pick up the scattered pages, he burst into silent and bitter tears. The kind-hearted nurse, Praskovya Fyodorovna, came by to check on Ivan during the storm and was upset to see him crying. She closed the blinds so that the lightning would not frighten him, picked up the papers from the floor, and ran off with them to get the doctor. The doctor appeared, gave Ivan an injection in his arm, and assured him that he would stop crying, that now everything would pass, everything would change, and all would be forgotten. The doctor turned out to be right. The wood across the river started to look as it had before. It stood out sharply, down to the last tree, beneath the sky which had been restored to its former perfect blueness, and the river grew calm. Ivan's anguish began to diminish right after the injection. And now the poet lay peacefully, gazing at the rainbow spread across the sky. Things stayed this way until evening, and he never even noticed when the rainbow evaporated. The sky faded and grew sad, and the wood turned black. Ivan drank some hot milk, lay down again, and was himself surprised at how his thoughts had changed. The image of the demonic, accursed cat had somehow softened in his memory. The severed head no longer frightened him, and when Ivan stopped thinking about the head, he began to reflect on how the clinic wasn't so bad, everything considered, and how Stravinsky was a clever fellow and a celebrity, and extremely pleasant to have dealings with. And besides, the evening air was sweet and fresh after the storm. The asylum was falling asleep. The frosted white lights in the quiet corridors went out, and in accordance with regulations, the faint blue nightlights came on, and the cautious steps of the nurses were heard less frequently on the rubber matting in the corridor outside the door. Now Ivan lay in a state of sweet lethargy, gazing now at the shaded lamp, which cast a mellow light down from the ceiling, now at the moon, which was emerging from the black wood. He was talking to himself. Why did I get so upset over Berlioz falling under a streetcar? The poet reasoned. In the final analysis, let him rot. What am I to him anyway, kith or kin? If we examine the question properly, it turns out that I, essentially, didn't really know the deceased. What did I actually know about him? Nothing. Except that he was bald and horribly eloquent. And so, citizens, continued Ivan, addressing an invisible audience, let us examine the following. Explain, if you will, why I got so furious at that mysterious consultant, magician, and professor with the black vacant eye. What was the point of that whole absurd chase with me in my underwear carrying a candle? And what about that grotesque scene in the restaurant? But, said the old Ivan to the new Ivan, addressing him in a stern voice from somewhere inside his head or behind his ear. But didn't he know in advance that Berlioz's head would be cut off? How could you not get upset? What is there to discuss, comrades? Retorted the new Ivan to the broken-down old Ivan. Even a child can see that there is something sinister about all this. He is, no doubt about it, a mysterious and exceptional personality. But that's what makes it so interesting. The fellow was personally acquainted with Pontius Pilate. What could be more interesting than that? And instead of making that ridiculous scene at Patriarch's Ponds, wouldn't it have been better to have asked him politely about what happened next to Pilate and the prisoner Hanotsri? But instead I got obsessed with the devil knows what. Is it such an earth-shattering event that an editor got run over? Does it mean the magazine will have to close down? So what can you do? Man is mortal, and, as was said so fittingly, sometimes suddenly so. Well, God rest his soul. There'll be a new editor, and maybe he'll be even more eloquent than the last one. After dozing off for a while, the new Ivan asked the old Ivan, spitefully, "So how do I look in all this?"
Like a fool,
a bass voice pronounced distinctly, a voice which did not come from either one of the Ivans, and was amazingly reminiscent of the consultant's bass. For some reason, Ivan did not take offense at the word fool, but was pleasantly surprised by it, smiled, and fell into a half-sleep. Sleep was creeping up on Ivan, and he could already see a palm tree on an elephant-like trunk, and a cat went by, not a fearsome one, but a jolly one. And in short, sleep was about to engulf him, when suddenly the window grill moved aside noiselessly, and a mysterious figure who was trying to hide from the moonlight appeared on the balcony and shook a warning finger at Ivan. Not feeling the least bit afraid, Ivan raised himself in bed and saw that there was a man on the balcony. And this man pressed his finger to his lips and whispered, "Shh." Chapter 12. Black Magic and its Exposé. A little man with a pear-shaped, raspberry-colored nose, wearing checked trousers, patent leather shoes, and a yellow bowler hat full of holes, rode out onto the stage of the Variety Theater on an ordinary two-wheeled bicycle. He made a circle to the accompaniment of a foxtrot, and then let out a triumphant hoot as he made his bicycle stand up on end. While riding on just the back wheel, the man turned upside down and managed at the same time to unscrew the front wheel and send it off stage. He then continued his ride on the one wheel, pedaling with his hands. Next appeared a buxom blonde in tights and a short skirt speckled with silver stars, who circled around on a unicycle perched on top of a long metal pole. As they passed each other, the man shouted out greetings and tipped his hat to her with his foot. The last to come out was a child of about 8, with an old man's face, who darted in between the two adults on a tiny two-wheeler outfitted with a huge automobile horn. After making several loops, the entire company pedaled up to the very edge of the stage to the accompaniment of an anxious drum roll from the orchestra. The spectators seated in the front rows gasped and pulled back in their seats, for it seemed as if all three performers were about to come crashing down into the orchestra with their cycles. But the bicycles stopped short, just as their front wheels threatened to skid off into the orchestra pit and onto the musicians' heads. With a loud cry of "Oop!" the cyclists jumped off their bikes and bowed, and the blonde threw kisses to the audience, while the child made a funny noise on his horn. The theater shook with applause, and the pale blue curtain drew together from both sides, hiding the cyclists from view. The green lights of the exit signs went out, and in the web of the trapezes under the dome, the white globes of the house lights began to blaze like the sun. It was the intermission, before the final part of the program. The only person to have no interest whatsoever in the wonders of the Giuli family's cycling technique was Grigory Danilovich Rimsky. He was sitting all alone in his office, biting his thin lips, and his face kept twitching convulsively. Likhodyeyev's strange disappearance was now compounded by the utterly unforeseen disappearance of the manager Varenuha. Rimsky knew where he had gone, but he had gone there and not come back. Rimsky hunched his shoulders and whispered to himself, "But why?" And what is odd is that it would have been simpler than anything for a man as businesslike as the financial director to call the place where Varenuha had gone and find out what had happened to him. However, 10 o'clock was approaching, and he still couldn't bring himself to do it. At 10, Rimsky took himself firmly in hand and picked up the receiver, only then to discover that his phone was dead. The messenger boy reported that the other phones in the building were also out of order. This admittedly unpleasant but hardly supernatural occurrence completely unnerved the financial director and yet delighted him as well. He wouldn't have to make the call. Just as the red light signaling the start of intermission began to flicker above the financial director's head, the messenger boy came in and announced that the foreign artiste had arrived. For some reason, this made the financial director wince with pain. Turning darker than a storm cloud, he headed backstage to receive the guest artiste, there being no one left but him to do so. Those who were curious were using various pretexts to peer into the large dressing room off the corridor where the bells signaling the end of intermission were already ringing. Among them were conjurers in bright robes and turbans, a roller skater in a white knitted jacket, a storyteller whose face was pale with powder, and a makeup man. The visiting celebrity astounded everyone with his unusually long and splendidly cut tailcoat, and by the fact that he was wearing a black eye mask. But even more amazing were the black magician's two companions, a tall fellow in checks with a broken pince-nez and a fat black cat who walked into the dressing room on his hind paws and then proceeded to make himself comfortable on the couch, squinting at the naked bulbs on the makeup mirror. Trying to put a smile on his face, which only made it look sour and mean, Rimsky bowed to the silent magician, who was sitting on the couch next to the cat. No one shook hands, but the overly familiar fellow in checks introduced himself as their assistant. This surprised the financial director, and unpleasantly so, since there had been absolutely nothing in the contract about any assistant. Dryly and very tensely, Grigory Danilovich asked the fellow in checks, who had fallen on him out of the blue, where the artiste's equipment was.
"Why, our most precious director, our diamond from heaven, how quaint you are!" answered the magician's assistant in a quavering voice. "Our equipment is always with us. Here it is, eins, zwei, drei."
He then wiggled his gnarled fingers in front of Rimsky's eyes and suddenly pulled out Rimsky's gold watch and chain from behind the cat's ear. Up until now, it had been in the financial director's vest pocket, underneath his buttoned jacket, with its chain looped through the buttonhole. Rimsky grabbed his stomach involuntarily. The onlookers gasped, and the makeup man, who was peering in through the door, clucked approvingly.
"Could this be your watch? Please take it," said the fellow in checks, smiling in an overly familiar way as he handed the flustered Rimsky his property on a grubby palm.
"You wouldn't want to get on a streetcar with the likes of him," whispered the storyteller gaily to the makeup man.
But then the cat pulled a trick that was even more skillful than the one with Rimsky's watch. Suddenly rising from the couch, he walked on his hind paws to the table under the mirror, pulled the stopper out of the carafe, poured some vodka into a glass, drank it, put the stopper back in place, and then wiped his whiskers off with a makeup rag. This time, no one even gasped. Mouths simply opened wide, and the makeup man whispered ecstatically, "Now that's first class." At this point, the third bell rang, and everyone, keyed up and anticipating an exciting act, rushed out of the dressing room. A minute later, the lights dimmed in the auditorium, and the footlights came on, casting a reddish glow on the bottom of the curtain. A stout fellow, clean-shaven and cheerful as a baby, wearing rumpled tails and soiled linen, appeared through the brightly lit opening in the curtain and stood before the audience. This was the master of ceremonies, Georgi Bengalsky, well-known to all of Moscow.
"And so, citizens," began Bengalsky, smiling a baby-like grin, "now I would like to present..."
Here he interrupted himself and began speaking in a different tone.
"I see that our audience has increased for the third part of the program. Half the city is here with us today. Just recently, I met a friend and said to him, 'Why don't you come and see us? Yesterday, half the city was here.' And he says, 'But I live in the other half.'"
Bengalsky paused, expecting a burst of laughter. But when none came, he continued.
"And so I would like to present the famous foreign artiste, Monsieur Voland, in a performance of black magic. Of course, you and I know," here Bengalsky smiled a knowing smile, "that there is no such thing in the world as black magic, and it is nothing other than superstition, and that Maestro Voland is simply a master of conjuring technique. A fact which will become obvious in the most interesting part of his performance, that is, when he reveals the secrets behind his technical skill. And so, since we all applaud both expertise and its exposé, let us welcome Mr. Voland."
After delivering this whole spiel, Bengalsky pressed his palms together and waved them in welcoming fashion at the opening in the curtain, whereupon it drew apart with a soft rustle. The entrance of the magician, with his tall assistant and his cat, who came out on stage on his hind paws, made a big hit with the audience.
"An armchair, if you will," Voland commanded softly, and that very second an armchair appeared on stage out of nowhere, and the magician sat down.
"Tell me, dear Fagot,"
inquired Voland of the buffoon in checks, who obviously had another name besides Korovyov,
"have the Muscovites changed, in your opinion, in any significant way?"
The magician looked out over the hushed audience, which was still stunned by the chair's sudden appearance out of thin air.
"Indeed they have, monsieur,"
was Fagot Korovyov's soft reply.
You are right. They have changed a great deal. On the outside, I mean, as has the city, by the way. Apart from the obvious changes in dress, there are now these